At that time, I was still a soldier. Physically and mentally, I had the polish of 6 years of service, so that in the beginning, this circle must have looked on me as quite a stranger. In common with my army comrades, I had forgotten such phrases as, "That will not go," or "That is not possible," or "We ought not to take such a risk. It is too dangerous." The whole undertaking was, of its very nature, dangerous. At that time, there were many parts of Germany where it would have been absolutely impossible openly to invite people to a national meeting that dared to make a direct appeal to the masses. Those who attended such meetings were usually dispersed and driven away with broken heads. It certainly did not call for any great qualities to be able to do things in that way. The largest so-called bourgeois mass meetings were accustomed to dissolve, and those in attendance would run away like rabbits when frightened by a dog, as soon as a dozen communists appeared on the scene. The Reds used to pay little attention to those bourgeois organizations where only babblers talked. They recognized the inner triviality of such associations much better than the members themselves, and therefore felt that they need not be afraid of them. On the contrary, however, they were all the more determined to use every possible means of annihilating once and for all any movement that appeared to them to be a danger to their own interests. The most effective means which they always employed in such cases were terror and brute force. The Marxist leaders, whose business consisted in deceiving and misleading the public, naturally hated most of all a movement whose declared aim was to win over those masses which hitherto had been exclusively at the service of international Marxism in the Jewish and Stock Exchange parties. The title alone, German Labour Party, irritated them. It could be easily foreseen that at the first opportune moment we should have to face the opposition of the Marxist despots who were still intoxicated with their triumph in 1918. People in the small circles of our own movement at that time showed a certain amount of anxiety at the prospect of such a conflict. They wanted to refrain as much as possible from coming out into the open, because they feared that they might be attacked and beaten. In their minds, they saw our first public meetings broken up, and feared that the movement might thus be ruined forever. I found it difficult to defend my own position, which was that the conflict should not be evaded, but that it should be faced openly, and that we should be armed with those weapons which are the only protection against brute force. Terror cannot be overcome by the weapons of the mind, but only by counter-terror. The success of our first public meeting strengthened my own position. The members felt encouraged to arrange for a second meeting on an even larger scale. Sometime in October 1919, the second, larger meeting took place in the Erbel Braukeller. The theme of our speeches was Brest-Litovsk and Versailles. There were four speakers. I talked for almost an hour, and the success was even more striking than at our first meeting. The number of people who attended had grown to more than 130. An attempt to disturb the proceedings was immediately frustrated by my comrades. The would-be disturbers were thrown down the stairs, bearing imprints of violence on their heads. A fortnight later, another meeting took place in the same hall. The number in attendance had now increased to more than 170, which meant that the room was fairly well filled. I spoke again, and once more the success obtained was greater than at the previous meeting. Then I proposed that a larger hall should be found. After looking around for some time, we discovered one at the other end of the town, in the Deutschen Reich, in the Dachauer Straße. The first meeting at this new rendezvous had a smaller attendance than the previous meeting. There were just less than 140 present. The members of the committee began to be discouraged, and those who had always been skeptical were now convinced that this falling off in the attendance was due to the fact that we were holding the meetings at too short intervals. There were lively discussions in which I upheld my own opinion that a city with 700,000 inhabitants ought to be able not only to stand one meeting every fortnight, but 10 meetings every week. I held that we should not be discouraged by one comparative setback, that the tactics we had chosen were correct, and that sooner or later success would be ours if we only continued with determined perseverance to push forward on our road. The whole winter of 1919 to 1920 was one continual struggle to strengthen confidence in our ability to carry the movement through to success, and to intensify this confidence until it became a burning faith that could move mountains. Our next meeting in the small hall proved the truth of my contention. Our audience had increased to more than 200. The publicity effect and the financial success were splendid. I immediately urged that a further meeting should be held. It took place in less than a fortnight, and there were more than 270 people present. 2 weeks later, we invited our followers and their friends for the seventh time to attend our meeting. The same hall was scarcely large enough for the number that came. They amounted to more than 400. During this phase, the young movement developed its inner form. Sometimes we had more or less hefty discussions within our small circle. From various sides, it was then just the same as it is today, objections were made against the idea of calling the young movement a party. I have always considered such criticism as a demonstration of practical incapability and narrow-mindedness on the part of the critic. Those objections have always been raised by men who could not differentiate between external appearances and inner strength, but tried to judge the movement by the high-sounding character of the name attached to it. To this end, they ransacked the vocabulary of our ancestors with unfortunate results. At that time, it was very difficult to make the people understand that every movement is a party as long as it has not brought its ideals to final triumph and thus achieved its purpose. It is a party even if it give itself 1,000 different names. Any person who tries to carry into practice an original idea whose realization would be for the benefit of his fellow men will first have to look for disciples who are ready to fight for the ends he has in view. And if these ends did not go beyond the destruction of the party system, and therewith put a stop to the process of disintegration, then all those who come forward as protagonists and apostles of such an ideal are a party in themselves, as long as their final goal is reached. It is only hair-splitting and playing with words when these antiquated theorists, whose practical success is in reverse ratio to their wisdom, presume to think they can change the character of a movement which is at the same time a party by merely changing its name. On the contrary, it is entirely out of harmony with the spirit of the nation to keep harping on that far-off and forgotten nomenclature which belongs to the ancient Germanic times and does not awaken any distinct association in our age. This habit of borrowing words from the dead past tends to mislead the people into thinking that the external trappings of its vocabulary are the important feature of a movement. It is really a mischievous habit, but it is quite prevalent nowadays. At that time, and subsequently, I had to warn followers repeatedly against these wandering scholars who were peddling Germanic folklore and who never accomplished anything positive or practical except to cultivate their own superabundant self-conceit. The new movement must guard itself against an influx of people whose only recommendation is their own statement that they've been fighting for these very same ideals during the last 30 or 40 years.